Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail.
We do.
We got so much mail. My name is William DeBiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may, if you wish, call me Rockmeister McCool.
Mm-hmm.
But you needn't.
All I got is Bibbs. You win. My name is Bibbs. Yeah, I just did
you
that,
said
didn't
that
I?
Part.
Anyway, here's
this is our letters podcast. This is your podcast.
Just once,
dear listeners.
Just once, I want to record before we're exhausted. Anyway,
nope, that's kind of our shtick.
That's our brand.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, let's
will I fall asleep on podcast again? I've done it before.
Let's tune into the tired guys.
Really takes a lot of the edge off, doesn't it? Anyway,
it's like the really calming morning drive time NPR. Like, this is NPR News. Thank you for tuning in. There was a terrible disaster somewhere in the world today. Many people died. Like, they have that really relaxing voice.
Yeah, a little too relaxing, yeah.
Yeah, that's us. Just, you know, it's the end of the day. It's like, thanks for tuning in to our letters episode. We're going to read your letters.
Frank Capra, quite interesting.
Snark. Frank Capra. This is our letters podcast. You can write into our email address. William, what is our email address?
Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us an actual physical letter. We like those. We'll crinkle the paper on mic just so you know we got it. Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and this is your show. You can ask us anything you want. Feel free to take us to task if we made a mistake on a previous podcast. Stranger things have happened. We recently did an episode of The Iron List where we talk about the best legal thrillers. If anyone wants to share their favorites that we may have missed, we would love to hear it. But yeah, basically, the floor is yours. Feel free to talk about anything you want or force us to talk about anything you want.
You can't Whitney? Force me to do nothing. No, but I'll read
it. Whitney, I'm going to force you to read this first email. So who is this first email
This
from?
First email is from B. Peterson.
Oh, hi, B.
Who requested I read this last week, and I was a dingbat. Yep. I will say that on mic openly in front of everybody. I was dingbat.
Language.
Because
language
I
is what you just used to express yourself?
Excuse me. Fucking dingbat.
Thank you.
And now I'm getting around to it. So okay. better
apologies.
Late. Apologies, better late than never, mark. Dear Cinnamon and the Fiendish Dr. Zoltan.
That is a deep cut.
Oh, yeah. That's a pilot I wrote a long time ago.
Yeah.
I guess it was an idea I pitched. I didn't really write
it. It was going to be like a web series where you were a mad scientist and I was your like Tor Johnson-esque sidekick. And I was named Cinnamon for some reason.
Cinnamon, yeah. And you're going to wear a vest and just grunt a lot.
Yeah.
And I had like undead cheerleader sidekicks. And then the mayor of Deadsville was going to come over.
That'd be a cool show.
The mayor was going to be played by Mark Edward Hoyk. Everybody agreed to do this.
I'm not sure. I wasn't exactly flattered to be Cinnamon, but I would have done it.
I asked you if you wanted to and you said yes.
At the time, I was honored that you would ask, but in retrospect, I think I would have wanted a different role.
All right,
but in any case,
but the idea was it wasn't just like a sitcom. We were going to be horror hosts.
Yeah,
we were going to like introduce a movie, and you could watch it on YouTube and then watch.
We would
the
have
movie.
Been like Svengoolie. It would have been great. That's the dream.
I wanted to be a horror host. I liked that
I would
scene,
still want
so
to be
I came
a
up
host.
With this whole thing.
If anyone wants to hire us to be
cheap
way
to like actually like build like a little miniature set and get all the beakers.
If anyone knows like a small town television station that's looking for a horror host, like we'll move. We will do
somewhere
it.
Somewhere in Alberta, we'll do it.
Nice,
Dear Cinnamon and the Fiendish Dr. Zoltan.
Back to the letter.
Yeah, we'll put this off long enough. Hear me out. For I have a theory that could potentially revolutionize cinema. Instead of a regular theater, you're in a giant dome-like room with no lights, walled with 7,080 blank tiles, which cover large speakers. You enter via a door in the floor. So you're like inside a giant golf ball.
Wasn't that a Richard Gere movie, The Door in the Floor?
Wasn't that a Stephen King movie?
No, I feel like that was like...
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Secret Window.
No, Door in the Floor. I'm going to look it up.
All right. In this room, there are 7,080 projectors, each projecting on us. Projecting a screen onto their respective tile in the room and with a sound connection with a speaker behind it. Being shown on each screen is
Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger.
There you go.
All right, my bad. It was a John Irving novel.
All right. Being shown on each one of these screens on the interior of this gigantic golf ball kind of scenario is Terrence Malick's masterpiece, Knight of Cups.
Oh.
With each projection offset by 1 second from the last, so that on the... 7,080 screens at any given time each second of the film will be visible or audible somewhere in the dome. Now, if my theory is correct, a Knight of Cups can indeed slow down the passage of time to a near standstill. I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not. Yes. Then the effect will be compounded, and one could theoretically live forever as if they chose to stay in the dome in an aesthetic immortality. Am I crazy? Is there a film that you would like to see presented in this format? Discuss. Thank you, and see you in the next one. B. Peterson.
The Knight of Cups theory stems from a Terrence Malick film called Knight of Cups. Terrence Malick is a filmmaker who has made some of, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, at least some of the better movies ever made. The Tree of Life, Badlands, Days of Heaven, probably The Thin Red Line, and I think you in particular would go to bat for, is it Hidden Life?
Hidden Life is great, yeah.
Yeah, you liked it more than I did, but it's really great. He's also made some real turds. So he went through this weird, long, decades-long period where he did almost nothing. Mm. He did, like, some script rewrites here and there, but he directed no movies after doing two of the best movies of the 70s.
And he came back in the late 90s.
Yep, same year Saving Private Ryan came out, he came out with a fantastic World War II film called The Thin Red Line. And then after that, he didn't work, like, super consistently, but he'd churn out a movie every few years. Which was pretty good for Terrence Malick. Like, we didn't used to get them that often, so I'll take one every three or four years.
It's like Steven Soderbergh for Terrence Malick.
Yeah, like, that was pretty good. And then, for whatever reason, in the 2010s, he hit, like, a stride and just kept churning them out. And he did The Tree of Life, was one of the best movies ever made. He did, I forget which order it was, he did A Knight of Cups and Song to Song.
Knight of Cups was first, and then Song to Song was right out. Like, within less than a year of each other.
I think they might have been even shot simultaneously at times. Those movies are bad. Those are bad movies.
Song to Song's fine. I didn't see Knight of Cups.
Song to Song is a coherent narrative. That's about as far as I'm willing to go with Song to Song. Knight of Cups, I cannot say that. And it's not like... Oh, what was that, Ben? To the Wonder. He also did To the Wonder in that time.
I like
that's
to the
a good
Wonder
movie
as well, yeah.
That's a good movie.
Right after Tree of Life, he did To the Wonder like 2 years later.
And people gave it crap because they thought it was too similar to Tree of Life. And like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, he's a brilliant filmmaker making variations on a theme.
He's just being, like, providing you elation again
way. What a nightmare. Like, but, and unfortunately that movie didn't do well. And he jumped into these two smaller projects with really big casts. And Song to Song is about the music scene. And some of it was shot at, like South by Southwest.
The concert scene. Yeah,
like the music industry. And Knight of Cups was about ostensibly Hollywood types, but it's mostly people walking around thinking about disconnected things. And it's interminable.
Sounds fine. That's what Richard Linklater movies tend to be about sometimes.
Yeah, no, but those movies tend to be connected in a way that makes sense that you're watching them all together. Maybe they're disparate, but there is at least some reason they're all in the same movie. When it comes to Knight of Cups, it's just kind of obtuse for its own purposes. It's definitely about someone who's got his head up his own butt. Like, that's the protagonist of the film. But there's no great depth there. There's just empty pathos. And honestly, I think it's his worst film. I think it is a very difficult film to sort of sit through, just because after a while it's like, I get it. I see what you're doing.
You're not expanding your point.
You're not illuminating anything. I'm not coming to any greater understanding about the characters or the universe. This feels like you had a bunch of footage and put it together. And that was the end-all, be-all of it. I'm sure he had great ambition. The movie doesn't work. So the idea of being trapped in, like, a universe of Knight of Cups, where every single thing you see is Knight of Cups, but every single frame is represented simultaneously, and it is all traveling in order, and everywhere you go is Knight of Cups, sounds like sounds like a Harlan Ellison story, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound like just this weird, oblique nightmare?
Well, B asked if like being inside this media nightmare would somehow slow down time, and you would just be there eternally.
I think you'd just be bored eternally, which feels like the slowing down of time, but I don't think it literally is, though.
I know that's an effect of being high. It's like a weird change in the way you perceive time.
It just sort of... Yeah, it can be.
All right.
Yeah, but it doesn't change time.
I mean, perception of time. We just made up time. Time is just kinda, an idea, but... So, you know, the way you perceive it can change, then time itself does change.
I mean, that's the basic concept of relativity, but it's also... Yeah. Mm. Listen, I'm going to say this right now. I would like to ask any of our listeners, especially the billionaires with a lot of money to spend. You know who you are. Let's try it.
We have a lot of billionaires listening to us.
Let's do the Knight of Cups experiment, and let's try to actually, like, halt time through the exclusive use of Terrence Malick's Knight of Cups. The only real problem is tracking... How many was it? Was it like 14,000?
It's a couple thousand. That's a lot.
I'm gonna just... You can look it up and get the right number. Let's say 14,000 screens, give or take.
All
right. Good luck finding that many DVDs of Knight of Cups.
Well, you get little tiny digital projectors. You don't need that many DVDs of it.
But you're going to need each one playing separately.
Yeah, just
get so that you're going to need that many DVDs.
You're going to need that many projectors.
Yes, and DVDs to show on those projectors.
No, you can
can't use the same DVD for each one.
But you can just get a different video file for each one.
Dude, I'm not getting
that. You don't need a physical media for this kind of project.
I think there's a limit to how many screens you're allowed to use your Amazon Prime membership on. So either way, you still need thousands of Amazon Prime memberships.
Oh man, can I borrow like 5,000 passwords to get Knight of Cups up at the same time? At my old theater job at the New Art, which I worked there for like 13 years, after hours, one of my coworkers, a very creative young man named Andy,
we did our music, didn't he?
He did our theme song. Was able to
get not the B Movies podcast, the other one, the Cancel Too Soon song, by the way.
Yeah,
just credit where credit is due. Yeah,
but we got this ad that we really hated.
Mm.
It was a travel ad of some kind, and there was a clip of this middle-aged guy saying, "This is the best Thai food I've ever had," like in this sort of East Coast accent.
Yeah.
And we got multiple copies of this ad on 35mm film. I don't know why. We're not going to run it multiple times. We have one screen. It's one screen theater.
Yeah.
So what he did is he laid two strips of the same ad over each other, which I think were like maybe six frames removed from each other.
Okay.
And then he'd run them layered together. He'd run a loop of just the one line of him saying, "This is the best Thai food I've ever had." But what he did is he laid them together, and then he made one loop, I think... What he did was he made one loop six frames smaller than the other. So they run through the projector, and they'd eventually start falling out of sync. So it's like this kind of double thing. This is the best Thai food. This is the best. And...
it's an experimental short.
This kind of experimental short, and he and I watched that for 30 minutes before it came back around and synced up again.
Oh my god.
That was a really fascinating experiment. That was like a really cool, like, I wish I could like recommend that film experience. It was just something he was doing in his time to dick around. So I've seen some interesting things that's, done with projectors.
That's like, do you remember when DVD players had, they might still, but they had screensavers. So like if your TV was on for too long without anything happening, they would go to a black screen so there wouldn't be a burn-in, which was more of an issue back when everyone had cathode ray TVs.
Still happens with flat screens too.
Still could happen, but it was a real serious issue with cathode rays. But there were the DVD... a lot of the DVD screensavers were a black screen with the DVD logo, DVD kind of little disc in the bottom.
Bouncing around.
And it would bounce from corner to corner to screen. And I know I'm not alone on this. I've had conversations with people. I have, in my weaker moments, just watched that screensaver waiting for it to perfectly hit the corner.
Just going at 45 degrees and bounce
just
back.
Yeah, like not just like just bounce off the corner and then hit the other corner, like carom off of it like a billiard ball. Like, no, just boom, the corner. It does happen. It is not easy to get to it, but it will happen if you're patient.
Okay. I never waited. I didn't care to see it. That I didn't have that thing.
Yeah. By the way,
some of those weird experimental media things are fun to do. We got to when you get a digital projector, you can actually, and this actually goes back to the Knight of Cups thing, you can line up a file to play repeatedly. Mm-hmm. You can have one file and just run it on sort of like a little schedule you can set up for a digital projector so you can do things automatically. And before the Rocky Horror Picture Show, when it converted to digital, we had a digital file of the our feature presentation that you see at the beginning of Kill Bill. And we'd play that once, and then we'd show the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Just for funsies one night, when I was projecting,
I
lined up six of those in a row. So everybody's waiting for it, and then it starts again. Oh, I messed up. Third time. By the time it's the fourth time, people have already lost their fucking minds.
Right.
And by the time you get to six, it's just bedlam in the theater. People are screaming and tearing down the carpet on the walls. Then the movie begins, and they don't know what to do.
By the way, speaking of experimental film, B. Peterson has just completed, I haven't had a chance to watch it all yet, but they completed a new project where they turned the 3-hour movie, The Batman, into like an hour and a half silent film. Mm-hmm. It's called The Batman Silent Night, and you should follow them on Twitter, and you can check that out.
Yeah.
They are at Blue Gray Closet, so definitely want to you can find the link pretty easy.
Yeah.
Let's move on. That's right. That's an interesting experiment, and again, if anyone has $1 billion, let's do it. Let's stop time together.
This is how you know billionaires aren't interesting people.
Yeah.
Because then we'd have this already.
Yeah, like, oh, we're going to go to space. We've been to space. Have we done the Knight of Cups experiment?
Oh, I'm going to use my $1 billion to change laws to keep billions of dollars. Build a robot dinosaur, you fucker!
We've had a robot dinosaur.
Build one you ride around town on.
Okay, yes, that's a good point. Moving on.
All right, here's a letter from Ryan. Hey guys, hope all is well. On a recent mailbag episode, a listener asked about asexual representation in film.
Yep.
And you guys listed a few good examples. I wanted to add one. Mm. I've seen positive ace representation, positive ace response to online, and that's Warren Beatty as Clyde Barrow.
Interesting.
In the 1967 classic Bonnie and Clyde.
Huh. A romantic asexual, but yeah,
they're pretty flirty with each other. Anyway,
that's romantic asexual.
Throughout the movie, Clyde repeatedly turns down Bonnie's sexual advances and even seems confused by them. And although it could be read as impotence or closeted homosexuality, I think it can be read as asexuality too. I'm not ace myself, so I can only recommend this so much, but having my own sexuality struggles, I always found Clyde a fascinating character, and I hope this helps someone out there. Best wishes, Ryan.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Funnily enough, this is actually just before I officially came out as graysexual, which I talked about on a recent Letters episode as well, and it's something I had been thinking about for a bit as I was coming to terms with this part of myself, and yeah, there aren't a lot of asexual characters who are frankly asexual. Well, like actually talk about it.
Use the term,
Yeah, but there are a lot of characters who behave in such a way that you look at them and go, like, this, clearly Bonnie and Clyde, like at the time, there wasn't really a lot of conversation about asexuality as an identity, so he wouldn't have known probably to even talk about that, but there are, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, or he might have been graysexual as well. You mentioned that he's romantic with Bonnie, and, you know, graysexuality is on the spectrum of asexuality. Doesn't mean he's never been interested. Doesn't mean he has no interest whatsoever. It just means it's very muted, or only briefly, or only occasionally, or whatever. So that might work. Yeah, I haven't seen Bonnie and Clyde in a little while, actually. Next time I'll watch it, I'll look at it with that lens. That's interesting.
Yeah. Because the term is, just in terms of cinema history, new. It's
relatively
not
new,
mentioned on screen ever. The more I've been thinking about it, the more I think Henry Higgins is actually a really great example.
That one came... Did someone bring that up after our podcast? I think someone, like, tweeted us about that.
No, I brought that up.
Okay,
But yeah, Henry Higgins from My Fair Lady, when he falls in love, he doesn't say, I'm in love, and he doesn't declare his romantic feelings. He says, I've grown accustomed to her face. He isn't responding to Eliza Doolittle in a sexual or even necessarily romantic way, but he seems to be experiencing a kind of longing that he doesn't really know how to process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good... example of sort of like an asexual response to getting, to a relationship.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't want to throw her down in the bedroom, but he wants, he's grown accustomed to her face.
I'm trying to remember if we mentioned, because we actually recently did a really fun podcast called The Incinerator, where we were given, we came up with a list of the greatest spoof movies ever made, and one by one, we picked a film to throw into the incinerator of history so that only one would survive. Erased,
yeah.
We talked about a lot of great spoof movies in that podcast, and one that we defended that most people do not is the 1960s version of Casino Royale.
That's a great movie.
Which is about asexuality. It is about how the swinging 60s were leaving...
Oversexed time.
Were so oversexed that they were leaving swinging spies open to being murdered by basically sexy villains. So they had to recruit David Niven, the original James Bond, and he's able to save the day because he's not interested in sex, and he has to train other spies who are not interested in sex or can be taught to be uninterested in sex and sort of put on asexuality as part of their cover. That's ahead of its time. People were not ready to have that talk.
And it's clearly a send-up of the over-sexualization of James Bond. That's what they're spoofing in that movie. But it's also, just sort of legit asexuality. And David Niven is clearly playing an asexual character.
Mm-hmm.
Not a character who is, proper and will only do it under certain circumstances. He has no interest.
Yeah, he has a daughter, but one gets the impression that I was maybe younger when he wasn't sure of himself. Mm-hmm. But, there's a whole extended sequence where he's in a house full of sexy women who are all trying to have sex with him. And it's just him being completely...
Mm-hmm.
Oblivious or disinterested in all of it. Yeah, and he's just like, can we please have tea? that's, again, I'll have to check out Bonnie and Clyde again through that lens. I haven't watched that movie in quite a few years.
I saw it as being incredibly romantic and sexual at the time, but maybe there's a lot I was missing.
Maybe.
Here's our next letter. This one comes from Ian. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Ian.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. Hope you are both fine and enjoying the summer weather. Jackknifing around here.
Today was brutally hot.
There's a one day heat wave, and then it's really overcast the rest of the time. Mm. Admittedly, I don't know what the weather is like in Los Angeles at the moment.
We just said.
But whatever it is, I hope you're enjoying it. Not that long ago, you read out a letter from a British bloke who mentioned that he was going to see Satan Tango in London on a big screen, remember?
Cool. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I also live in England, and it really pricked up my ears at this, so I live not that far from London, and Satan Tango is one of my favorite films.
Ooh.
I've seen it about 4 times on DVD. Watching it 4 times on DVD, that takes 3 weeks.
That's a long time.
It's 7.5 hours.
It's a very long film. Yeah. It's a long...
Admittedly, more than a day. Never in one sitting, though. I did some research, and yes, this last Sunday I spent over 8 hours in a tiny but wonderful art cinema called Close Up, just off Brick Lane in the London East End.
Nice.
It was fantastic, as expected. I can hardly believe that I've now seen this film on the big screen, surrounded by about 24 of like-minded people. Wow. I wonder if the guy who wrote you was also in the audience.
Maybe.
Basically, my heartfelt thanks to this person and to you two, because without listening to your wonderful podcast, I would never have known about this showing and about this brilliant cinema. I'm going again. Oh, yes, I will. This month, they are also showing Haneke's The White Ribbon.
Wow.
Robert Bresson's Pickpocket.
Wow.
The Safdie Brothers' Good Time.
Wow.
Lars von Trier's Melancholia. And to top it all off, Tarkovsky's Stalker.
Whitney, do you secretly run a movie theater in England?
That is
so fucking you. That's amazing.
Just here in Los Angeles, the American Cinematheque just had
a
series that they called Bleak Week.
Yeah.
And it was a week of films of the most depressing things you could possibly see. Lynn Ramsey double feature.
I wonder how many tickets they sell to Bleak Week.
Probably a lot. I understand it's sold out.
I'm glad to hear it.
They also did Satan Tango, and I really wanted to see Satan Tango on the big screen, and never got around to it.
I'm sorry. It'll come around again.
Yeah. I can hardly wait, so once again, thank you very much. I love you guys. Speaking of Satan Tango, do you know and or like other films by Béla Tarr? Are you familiar with Hungarian cinema? I would dearly love for you to take on, say, Miklós Jancsó, István Szabó, Zsoltán Husárik, and say, Ildiko and Yedi. I don't know that last one. As for me, I am deeply interested in Eastern Europe, especially Hungarian, Romanian, Czech, and Soviet Russian cinema, and I value your opinions about movies, and not just movies. Do you like huge, bleak, medieval Eastern European epics?
Again, let me introduce you to Whitney Seibold.
Yes,
that's like, you're describing his... If he still had a Tinder page, this would be what's on it.
I've never had a Tinder page.
Well, the point is, if you did, this would be on it.
Do you like films like Andrei Rublev or Hard to Be a God and like Marketa Lazarova? I've seen Marketa Lazarova. I think it's an Icelandic movie. These are some of my absolute favorites, seen many times. There are so few people I can share my love for this kind of cinema, though. I just wanted to finish that I've been listening to you since, 2016 or even before. My goodness. Without your voices and your aural presence, life would be much more unpleasant. I can assure you. Anyway, thank you for enough of my gushing. Have a lovely day, and thank you. Yours, Ian.
So that is incredibly kind. Stumbled over that one a little bit. Thank you, Ian. That's incredibly kind of you, and we're very, very grateful for those words. And thank you for joining us. Almost every single thing in your email was directed at Whitney. It's not that I actually have seen some Hungarian films, and I've liked some Hungarian films. I think White God was Hungarian, if memory serves.
The dog movie?
Yeah, wasn't White God Hungarian?
I believe so.
Yeah, I watched this interesting film a couple years ago called Ruben Brandt Collector. It was kind of a neat art heist animated film. Memory serves, that was Hungarian. I'll give it a think, see if I can remember anything else in particular. But when it comes to bleak cinema, Whitney is the guy. Whitney and Dave White over at Linoleum Knife, which is a podcast. If you like our podcast, you listen to them too. They're really wonderful film critics and funny guys. But Dave White also really loves bleak cinema. Whitney, talk a bit about bleak cinema, will you?
It's not like a genre unto itself. It's just
kind of is.
I guess if you're having a bleak week at the Cinematheque, but
those are movies from all
over the world, and they're all from all different times in history. It's just a certain type of movie that explores despair, sadness, and depression. A world where hope is not achievable. And sometimes when you're in your darker states, the world can feel like that. And I think it's nice to have a handshake waiting for you when you're in that kind of a mood. As for Bélatar specifically, I've only seen two Bélatar movies. Huh? I've seen Werkmeister Harmonies, and I've seen The Turin Horse, which I think was his last. I think it was his last movie, The Turin Horse. And The Turin Horse is about. If you don't know what The Turin Horse refers to, it refers to the horse in Turin that was being whipped in the street. It had fallen over and it was being whipped by its owner. This is supposedly a true story. When none other than Friedrich Nietzsche came walking by. Friedrich Nietzsche, known for his early existentialist sort of philosophies. He believed in a philosophy of the self. He talked about the will to power.
Right.
There's nothing ascetic about the world. There's nothing supernatural. There is just you. Work on yourself. And you might call that self-esteem, but think of like a sort of a stronger use of language than just mere self-esteem. It is about realizing your power. You are going to be better than others. He believed in sort of superiority. But not in domination, specifically. No. It was just about being strong. And he talked about the Übermensch, the overman. That's where we get the term Superman from. It was also, his philosophies were also really grievously and kind of intentionally misinterpreted by the Third Reich. This idea of a superior person led to Adolf Hitler talking about how, if there's a superior person, then surely there's a superior peoples, a superior nation, a superior race, that superiority denotes our right to dominate other people. None of that is part of Nietzsche's philosophy.
Right.
Nietzsche was walking down the street when he saw this horse being whipped in Turin. And he fell to his knees, hugging the horse, trying to defend it. And it was in that moment that he snapped. He went mad. Never wrote a word after that. And in fact, spent the rest of his life in an asylum. I think the last decade of his life was spent in an asylum. The turn horse is about the horse. Well, after it gets up, after Nietzsche hugged it, it gets up, and where does it go? And it goes out to this really sort of bleak village where this older couple is living, and the winds are picking up, and the sort of dirt blowing through the air is pervasive throughout the Turin horse. And then by the end of the movie, it just sort of blots out the sunlight, and that's kind of the end of the film. The world more or less ends in that movie. It's excellent. It's really, really cool watching these people struggle in this sort of deathscape for a long time. People like to watch post-apocalypse movies.
Sure.
Watch something like, The Omega Man or also I Am Legend, same story.
Yeah.
Where, everybody's dead, but now there's just, like, vampires or ghouls around. There's one guy left trying to sort of, like, solve a mystery as a quest.
Yeah.
He's sort of trashing department stores and just taking stuff for his own.
Yeah.
And there's sort of, there's two appealing things about that kind of post-apocalypse story.
What do you think, Barry?
One is the hope of the protagonist.
Yeah,
he's
going to
solve something. He has a quest.
Yeah, okay.
And once he solves it, either the audience will simply know about what happened, at the very least, mm-hmm. Or at the most, he'll somehow, like, restore something about the world.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he'll even, like, undo some of the damage that has been done. The other thing is your own end-of-the-world fantasy, being alone. And there was a really great bit on Mystery Science Theater where they talked about, what would you do if you were alone on Earth?
And, oh, yeah. Like, and, what do you do after the apocalypse?
Yeah, and Crow T. Robot said, I'm going to put on a suit of armor and just throw myself through plate glass windows.
Yeah.
And that's hilarious because that's what I would do.
Yeah, and I remember Tom Servo said, I would stop feeling self-conscious about renting films like Turner and Hooch and Three Men and a Little Lady. Here's the thing with that post-apocalyptic. You make excellent points. I think there are a few other elements to it. I think inherent in most post-apocalyptic movies, I think the actual post-apocalyptic movie would be nothing but landscape shots of a dead planet.
Wouldn't that be great?
But in actuality, most post-apocalyptic movies are about people who survive. Mm. There's an element of hope to it. The idea that society, or at least people, will live on even after we destroy ourselves, and that there will be some semblance of hope. I think this is one of the reasons why the movie The Road tends to freak people out, is because it's basically just saying, no.
There's no coming back.
There might be like a brief period after where not everyone is dead, but then they will be dead. Mm. But most like the Mad Maxes or whatever like that, there's an element of hope to it. That there will be something worth fighting for. There will be a chance to rebuild.
Yeah.
And the fundamental fantasy, which is, you alluded to it, some people will survive the apocalypse, and I'll probably be one of them.
Yeah,
and be very badass.
It's the Lord of the Wasteland fantasy. I want the world to end so I can be the survivor, and that, and with no rules, with the laws all undone, everything is now permissible. So it's just hedonism fantasy, really.
Yeah.
They're offering you hope. They're offering you succor. They're offering you comfort. That even in the bleakest of circumstances, there will be a glimmer. This has been sort of the operational ethos of most American cinema since the start. They're here to elate you in some way, to uplift you in some way, to make you feel, maybe make you think about something.
Sure.
Rarely to reach out to you and push you away.
Mm-hmm.
To do the opposite of comfort you.
Mm-hmm.
To rattle you, to disturb you, to offer you a world of no hope,
mm-hmm.
and how that is actually excitingly tantalizing in an artistic landscape that in its blander moments offers us nothing but comfort and excitement.
No, I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of media is trying to keep us from feeling that bleakness.
Mm. And so when you run into a film or a filmmaker who repeatedly visits these sorts of things, it's incredibly exciting.
Mm.
I'm reminded of all things, the Pixar film Inside Out, where we spend a lot of time in human heads and we get to see personifications of their emotions. And their emotions are represented by five basic states. Joy, sadness, disgust, fear, and anger.
Yeah.
Within each person, a different emotion is in charge. We get when we're in the head of an 11-year-old girl, joy is fighting to retain control, but sadness is invading.
Yeah.
We cut into the head of the mom, sadness is in control.
Mm-hmm.
We cut into the head of the father, anger is in control.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that movie is that we cannot live by just one experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like this amalgam, and the cathartic moment in Inside Out is when bittersweet is invented in the head of somebody, where something is joyous and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
I feel like each one of those beings, to use the Inside Out terminology, needs to be placated in some way. You need to see a film that makes you angry.
Yeah.
You need to see a film that makes you scared. I occasionally love to see a film that disgusts me.
Sure.
You need to see a film that makes you feel joy, and you definitely, definitely need films that make you feel sad.
I'm reminded I interviewed Pete Docter when that movie came out, and I asked him, no logic, huh? He actually said there was an early version where there was going to be a character who represented logic, but like, the second...
Like emotionless?
Yeah, but well, just the person who was... He was basically the one in charge. He was basically just like, okay, everybody, your emotions are in, but we need to keep cool, and we need to actually just go about our day. And like the second the plot kicked in, they were literally going to throw logic out of a window.
That's really cute.
And then they eventually realized they just didn't just need it. It was taking too long. But well said, Whitney. It's still not my favorite particular kind of cinema.
Yeah.
Perhaps because it does what it does too well. Mm. But well said. Celebration of bleak cinema.
István Csabó. You've seen István Csabó films, right? Like Mephisto?
I don't think I have, actually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, 1981, István Csabó made a film called Mephisto. I saw a really great István Csabó film called Sunshine in 1999.
Mm. Not to be confused
with the Danny Boyle film.
Oh, I was confusing with the Ralph Fiennes movie.
It is the Ralph Fiennes movie.
Isn't that 99? Is it 89?
No, 99. I apologize. Oh, no, in 99, he made a film with Ralph Fiennes. Ralph Fiennes played three generations of characters, like three generations of men over the course of World War II. He had to change his name and change his identity to survive. It's a really good movie. Not so bleak. I mean, it's about World War II. It's all of the horrors of that time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's not like a film specifically about sadness and depression.
Yeah.
I saw speaking of disgusting movies, a movie from the early 2000s from Hungary called Taxidermia.
Oh, that sounds fun. And that sounds like a treat.
And it's also about sort of three generations of men in Hungary throughout history. The first... it's pretty frank about bodily functions and sex and things. So he like lives on a farm and is constantly sneaking off to self-gratify. And when he climaxes, fire comes out, that sort of thing.
You should get that looked at.
Not like literal fire.
It's not just
burning.
Yeah.
The Next Generation, it's about a competitive eater who like overeats for a living and how he talks about how when he overeats, chambers in his body open up. Like he feels alive when he's overeating. And then we fast forward to when that character is an old man and his younger son, I believe, has become a taxidermist. And something really horrible happens to them.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, Taxidermia is pretty exhilarating as well.
Nice. Oh, we should move on, but thank you for this, and thank you for this conversation, and thank you for giving Whitney an opportunity to talk about one of his favorite things.
Just sad movies.
Yeah, people don't talk about him enough, just in general. So, thank you.
Here's an episode,
an installment.
A letter from Canadian Keith.
Hello, oh, hi, Canadian Keith.
Gentlemen, on May 21st, 2021, you released your most recent episode of Episode Zero. At the end of the episode, you announced that the next one would be the penultimate episode, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. I figured life must have gotten busy for you, and Episode Zero is pushed to the back burner, but I was curious if you still plan to come back to it to finish the season off, or if you consider it complete as is. Thank you for your time, Canadian Keith.
Okay, so Episode Zero is a show that we introduced a couple of years ago, and I still like the idea, was we were looking at the prehistory of incredibly popular things. Because no movie, except maybe the very first one, and even then, exists in a vacuum. They're all influenced by that which came before. And we spent 20 whole episodes talking about a variety of really disparate and interesting films that had a direct influence on Star Wars. Especially the first film, but also other films in the series. when that was done, we decided to do the same thing with the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm. And we did. And then we hit, I think about a, it became like another thing where like we just bit off more than we could chew. We had way too much in the chamber. And we were intending to do two more episodes. And then we didn't, obviously. Mostly because we ran out of time. But also, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I felt like we kind of covered most of it, and while it would have been nice to talk about a couple more things, well, we kind of did.
We did. I think we just wanted to wrap it up. Yeah. We wanted to talk about Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and I guess we can share now. The final episode was going to be for Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because that season of Episode Zero about the Rocky Horror Picture Show began with The Old Dark House, another James Whale film. So we wanted to begin and end with James Whale, kind of just bring it around full circle.
Two different films that had different influences on the story, but
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was this wild, sex-soaked romp done by Russ Meyer, rather infamously written by Roger Ebert. It was just this complete brazen showbiz melodrama with a lot of nudity, a lot of sex, and a lot of other twisted things in it besides. And overt sexuality definitely bled into the cult movie scene in a big way. I mean, that's what a lot of cult movies at the time were all about. And the Rocky Horror Picture Show definitely took influence from that.
It's also a film that very directly weaponized what we would now think of as camp. Which is something that the Rocky Horror Picture Show definitely took tonally, I think, from that movie. And honestly, like we've had a couple of requests to complete it. Maybe we could someday. I'm not sure if it's that much in demand. We were thinking about one day coming back to it and doing the prehistory of The Matrix, which would be fun.
The issue with that is a lot of what influenced The Matrix came from Star Wars, and we've already covered the things that influenced Star Wars.
That would probably be a shorter one, so that we didn't discover all the same material. I think we probably done like maybe 10 or 12 episodes of that. Mm. But there's definitely stuff we could have done. I think there's a lot of anime we could have talked about, a lot of martial arts cinema in particular, certain more
wuxia stuff.
Well, there's also more like heady sci-fi material, maybe more Philip K. Dick kind of stuff, that kind of thing. But it's a project we really, really like, and we are constantly coming up with projects we really, really like, and we don't have time to do the projects we're doing now, in case we're always struggling to fit everything into our schedule.
Barely stumbling over the finish line every week.
Yeah, so as much as I would love to go back to Episode Zero, I would love to go back and do a lot of things. Unfortunately, the podcasts are not the only thing we have to fit into our lives. Well, actually, I'm going to take that back. Fortunately, they're not the only things we have to fit into our lives. We have things like family and friends and other aspirations as well. So while this is very important to us, and we love doing what we do, and we do as many podcasts as we do because we like working and we like talking to each other and we like sharing cinema with all of you wonderful people, sometimes projects will come and go. If we get a lot of demand, if people just really want us to crank out the last two Episode Zeros, let us know. We can probably do it, but we felt pretty comfortable just letting it lay. It was a little anticlimactic, I'll grant you, but like we felt like it had mostly been covered.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd already done a James Whale movie. We'd already done a Russ Meyer movie. You know, we kind of just did it. But again,
we just wanted to talk about those movies because we like those movies.
Those movies kick ass, so we would totally do it. And we still could if anyone really, really wants us to. So if we get like a couple, probably won't do it. But if we get a lot, maybe. So if you want to leave us a comment, maybe on the Patreon page if you're a patron, or if you want to send us a Twitter message, we've gotten a few. I know a few people who are interested. If you're one of the people who really wanted that series to conclude properly with the final two episodes, let us know and we can do it. But you know, probably take us a little bit to get around to it.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on.
All right, here's a letter from Seth. Hello, Seth.
Hi, Seth.
Hi, Bibs and Wits. I was listening to your Iron List of legal thrillers, and I was a little taken aback that neither one of you mentioned one of my favorite courtroom thrillers / mysteries, Billy Wilder's adaptation of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution.
I will just flat out admit I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen that either.
Okay, it's a blind spot. We missed it. We're sorry.
Well, out in the game-changing pantheon of Sunset Boulevard, Double Indemnity, or Some Like It Hot, it's a very solid, taut legal thriller with a hell of a performance from Marlena Dietrich. I also love it because it is one of those great old movies where words are put on the screen at the end, telling the audience not to spoil the film.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, doing that apparently cost Marlena Dietrich an Oscar nomination, and if you see the film, you'll know why.
Oh, shit.
It is not just Ms. Dietrich's performance that excels, but also the great Charles Laughton as Tyrone Power's defense attorney, and of course Elsa Lanchester as his put upon nurse. Watching these two go at it on screen, the chemistry is so palpable you understand why they were together for over 30 years. However, I totally understand why it may have been forgotten. The legal thriller and drama genre is very vast in your podcast. There was so much John Grisham discussion that I was afraid Christmas with the Cranks would be brought up, maybe for a holiday list. A holiday list of films to avoid.
They don't sue the Cranks, so it doesn't count. Yeah, no, listen, Whitney and I love cinema, and we've seen a hell of a lot of it, and when we do these iron lists, I know there's at least a little research I try to do, like, okay, there's a couple of big ones I've never got around to, but, yeah, we're fallible. We missed a couple of big ones. There's a couple of big legal thriller movies we didn't get around to, we couldn't make the time for, we just happened to not have seen, and that's one we, unfortunately, neither of us have seen. So we missed it. You're not the only person who mentioned it. It is a film a lot of people really, really like. And I do intend to get around to it. It was on my list of things to try to make time for, but that episode of the Iron List was already like a week late. Yeah. It was supposed to come out in May. So we just had to bite the bullet and get it done. But thank you for bringing it up. And now people know how great it is, and hopefully they'll, be able to, hopefully the recommendation hits. We have time for one more letter?
Sure. Okay. Here's a letter from Eric.
Hello, hi, Eric.
Hello, gentlemen. Hope everything is going well with you both. Over this past year, I started a little project that I'm growing quite fond of and thought including you two in it might be fun for the both of us.
Okay.
In 2022, I decided to start a list. I started a list that set the whole world crying. No, I went back through all of the films I've seen in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Conveniently logged on Letterboxd and picked out my single favorite film for each year. So, for example, my favorite movie of 1989 is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Well, that's a great film.
And my favorite movie from 1948 is Bicycle Thieves.
That's a great double feature.
Where is my bike? Back in time, dude.
Picture Bill and Ted just stealing the guy's bike.
Oh, shit.
Oh, no, the bullying got away. Quick, get that guy's bike.
Oh, no, the sad guy. No, my bicycle. Then I collected all of these films and put them in a list sorted by chronological order of release date and discovered that between the years of 1920 and 2022, I've seen films from 87 unique years.
Okay.
Now, my list won't be complete until I've seen a film from every year between 1920 and 2022. So today I'm asking for recommendations.
Okay.
Below you will find a list of the years that I still haven't seen a film from.
Got it.
I would be honored if you two could each recommend a film from a couple of these years so I can watch them and add them to my list. If you can think of anything from these specific years, any recommendations are welcome. I'm always down to watch what you guys recommend. I trust you both of your judgment equally. Hopefully this is a fun topic and doesn't create a bunch of dead airtime.
Well, I can edit it if it takes us a minute. Right.
I appreciate you two taking the time to create all the content you do, from a fellow lover of film, Eric.
All right, what are yours?
So the years are 25 to 30. So 25.
1925, 1930, okay.
36, 38, 45 to 47, 49, 56, 62, and 69. Dude.
Nice. Hey, it's a Bill and Ted reference.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, let's see here. Now, again, we don't need to come up with the best things ever. No,
just recommended films from each of these years.
Do you want to start at the top and work your way down, or start at the bottom and work your way up, and we can meet in the middle?
I'll start at the top, and you start at the bottom. So
I'll look at something from 1925.
You start with 1969. I'll start with 1925.
That bottom. Yeah. Got it. Okay, 1969. And so we're just going to, again, we're not going to pick our favorite film. We're just going to pick a film we can solidly recommend from any of these years. And yeah, we're using the internet to help us reminder because that's a lot of films to remember the release date on.
Okay, so great films from 1925 that I can recommend away. Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
Yeah, the original Lon Chaney. That's great movie. One.
Yeah.
Battleship Potemkin. Came out in 1925. And The Unholy Three.
Great movie.
A Lon Chaney film done by Todd Browning. That's a really fun one.
Other
good ones besides.
Let's see. 1969. I would highly recommend the original Italian Job, starring Michael Caine. Midnight Cowboy, starring John Voight and Dustin Hoffman. I know, John Voight, but it's still a good movie. The original Bush... No, there was a sequel. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The original is not that weird thing to say. I'm trying to think. We just saw Cactus Flower. That was from 1969. That was a good movie. Let me see if I can think of like one more that might be like an interesting 1960... Oh, The Wild Bunch. There you go. 1969. Boom. Okay. The Wild Bunch. All right, I'm going to 1962.
I'm going to 1926. The General came out in 1926. The Buster Keaton movie. See, great. The General. That's
one of the best movies ever.
F.W. Murnau did a great version of Faust that year.
Mm.
The very first animated feature film, or at least the one that survives, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed by Lottie Reininger
came
out that year.
Yeah, it's the first one that survives. There are others, allegedly, but we haven't seen them.
Haven't seen a lot of other films from 1926. Okay, what do you got
All right, let's see. We got 1962. To Kill a Mockingbird and Lawrence of Arabia.
Those are two of the
biggest films of the middle of the decade. I'm trying to think if there's anything maybe a little more like fun than maybe those ones, which are awesome, but maybe might feel a little bit like work. Let's see, The Music Man. That's a very, very fun musical.
Oh, there you go.
Definitely worth checking out. Yep, that'll do it. Okay. And Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? Speaking of bleak, that's a great horror movie.
That's wonderful.
All right.
Okay. 27, we're getting into films that were nominated for Best Picture, so these are the things I'm a little bit more familiar with.
Yeah.
1927, also Fritz Lang's Metropolis came out that year.
Yeah, one of the best sci-fi films ever.
Sunrise is one of the best films ever made.
Yeah.
Sunrise and Wings both won Best Picture, and those are both definitely worth seeing. They're both really great. And if you've ever heard the term It Girl, refer to like a young starlet who's kind of on her way up, somebody who's like in the moment, that's referring to Clara Bow from a movie called It, which is not about a killer clown. It is sort of like indescribable appealing quality that some people have, and Clara Bow had it, so she was in a movie.
She was truly epic movie star, like absolutely star power.
Hated the sound era, and some might say her career was a horrendous victim of just sexism and abuse. But
Let's see here. Next up, I got 1956. I'm not going to do too deep a dive on here, but I will recommend Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, which is actually one of his more fun movies. It's actually a heist film. That's the year Forbidden Planet came out, another one of the great sci-fi films. Also, the serial killer film The Bad Seed.
Oh, that's a fun movie.
Super creepy, like a little... really straining at the edge of the production code there. So definitely check that one out.
Let's see. Came out in
49.
I'm looking up 1928 here, and I'm not seeing a lot that I'm actually super familiar with, apart from Steamboat Willie.
It's not a feature, though.
It's not a feature film. That's a short. I mean, a fine short. Not the first film with sound. Don't let Disney trick you.
No. Have they actually said that?
They have. They tried to
claim. Oh, my God.
They stopped saying it. They stopped, but for a long time, they tried to sort of sell that.
All the fucking things.
The temerity of them. You know what? 28, I'm kind of drawing a blank here.
I will check 28 in a second when I am done checking out 1949, which actually isn't a great year for me either, now that I'm looking at it. I've seen a few things here.
What came out in 1928? Un Chien Andalou.
There you go.
Came out in 1928.
Great example.
And of course, Passion of Joan of Arc.
We just talked about that. Yeah, that's a great one.
Definitely see the Passion of Joan of Arc. That one came out in 28.
Yeah, awesome movie.
And Speedy, the Harold Lloyd comedy.
I haven't seen that one.
All right, that's fun.
Let's see here. For 1949, I got a few fun ones here. I would recommend White Heat, starring James Cagney, one of the great gangster movies of all time. All right. Really fun early Don Siegel crime thriller called The Big Steal, starring Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer. And an early sci-fi epic called Mighty Joe Young, which is basically a ripoff of King Kong, but it's done by the same people, trying to evoke the same thing. There was a remake in the 90s with Charlize Theron and Bill Paxton. Worth checking out.
29.
Okay.
The Man Who Laughs. Love The Man Who Laughs. Mm-hmm. G.W. Pabst, Pandora's Box with Louise Brooks. That's a really good one. And Man with a Movie Camera is a pretty important movie.
It's very experimental, though. Don't walk in expecting something even remotely conventional. It's basically
it's like an elaborate found footage montage. Yeah, kind of documentary type of a thing. Like a whole feature.
Yeah. We actually just recently talked about 1947 in our podcast, Only the Best, where we talk about the best picture nominees of any given year. And among them was The Bishop's Wife, which is a very sweet Christmas movie starring Cary Grant, David Niven, and Loretta Young. Also, Crossfire was a very good murder mystery with a lot of topicality to it. Definitely worth checking out. Let's see. Oh, here's this movie makes me cry like nobody's business. The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, starring Gene Tierney and Rex Harrison, about a woman who moves into a house that's haunted by the ghost of an old sailor, and they fall in love, but it cannot be because he's dead and she's not. It's really, really, really sweet and really sad. The Lady from Shanghai is, if you can get past Orson Welles' not particularly good Irish accent, a very, very good film noir.
What? It's impeccable.
Sure. The Lucky Charms guy is more on the nose than Orson Welles. I think that's a good one. What do you got next?
I have 1930 here. Okay. Your film education isn't complete until you've seen All Quiet on the Western Front.
That's
one of the best movies ever.
One of the best movies ever made, no
doubt. It's also the same year as Animal Crackers, one of the better Marx Brothers movies.
That is a very good Marx Brothers movie, yeah.
What else from 1930?
Let's see.
The Blue Angel came out in 1930.
I don't know that one.
That's the Marlene Dietrich movie.
I never saw that. Okay. Let's see.
I haven't seen Dumbo.
Let's see here. Over in 1946. A lot of great classic movies came out in 1946, including The Best Years of Our Lives, which is one of the best movies ever made. It's a Wonderful Life, which is one of the best movies ever made. Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious, which is one of the best films ever made. And I wouldn't call it one of the best films ever made, but it's one of the better film noirs. Lana Turner and John Garfield in The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's one of those movies. Another one that's like really...
That's one I've been meaning to get to.
Yeah, that's one of those ones where the sex was so good we had to kill somebody. And that's kind of a hard genre to pull off in the production code. So, it feels like they're really straining against what they can do. But it is very steamy and very, very good for what they had there.
See, next on my list was 1936. Modern Times. Definitely. Fritz Lang's Fury.
Yeah.
I Love to Sing.
that's a short, but yeah.
That's a short. Kenji Mizoguchi's Osaka Elegy is a really interesting film about a woman who's sort of forced into marriage. Frank Capra's Mr. Deeds Goes to Town came out that year. And Swing Time, one of the better Mr. Rogers musicals, is in there. Dodsworth was a really fun one.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, wait.
I wasn't thinking, not Dodsworth. I was thinking of Ruggles Red Gap. Dodsworth's okay.
Dodsworth is fine. Yeah. Ruggles Red Gap, you gotta see. That movie's funny.
Yeah.
That movie is still to this day very, very, very
Oh, and Todd Browning's The Devil Doll came out in 1936.
I've never seen that.
Another Todd Browning. Todd Browning is a weakness of mine. I like Todd Browning.
I like Todd Browning, too. I just haven't seen that one, so I wasn't sure if that one was good or not. Let me see here. So next up, I have got 1945. Oh, there's a lot of great stuff to choose from in 1945. I'm going to recommend, amongst other things you could totally do if you wanted to, another good Christmas movie, The Bells of St. Mary's. It's one of Ingrid Bergman's most likable performances, which is saying something. Mildred Pierce, which is a very bitter noir. Christmas in Connecticut is one of my favorite romantic comedies. It's also one of my favorite Christmas movies. It is not the movie you think it's going to be. I always forget that it opens with the sinking of a battleship. Like, there's a lot in that movie that's, like, really just doing some interesting stuff. Really awesome British horror anthology called Dead of Night. Ending is chef's kiss. And, like, all but one of the ghost stories that they tell in it are, like, really good and genuinely creepy. That's really good. That's a great average for a horror anthology. And then lastly, I'm going to recommend Roberto Rossellini's Rome Open City, is one hell of a neorealist film. So you definitely got to check that out. And then that was 1945. And then
next I have 38.
And that's the last year we got.
So here we got in 1938. Robin Hood. That is The Adventures of Robin Hood, the yep. Michael Curtius movie.
One of the great adventure films.
Sergei Eisenstein's Alexander Nevsky, mm-hmm. another historical epic. Marcel Carné's Port of Shadows came out that year. That has a nice Criterion
edition. Oh, yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
You Can't Take It With You, another Frank Capra movie.
Yep, this was very funny.
The height of Frank Capra's career. Porky and Wacky Land, another short.
Yeah.
I love Porky and Wacky Land.
I know you do.
Let's see, what else have I seen from 1938?
Did Dead End come out that year? Was that Dead End?
Oh, that was Boys Town? Was that up against Dead End?
Boys Town, I think Boys Town did come out that year. I don't remember if that was on
Boys Town's pretty good. I like Boys Town. I think I liked it more than
But
you
Dead
did,
End was 37, never mind.
Okay.
All right. Terminal Realms was big in 38, but those are good.
Yeah.
All right, so there you go.
There's
there's some stuff for you to watch, and maybe someone else will want to watch those movies too. They're all really good. Mm. Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you want to mail us, if you want us to help you with your homework too, feel free. And this was fun, so thank you so much. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. Box if you prefer to send something in the old-fashioned way. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
I send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And again, we're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim, if you want to contact us like directly with something brief. We're also on, I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeinbold.
If you want to go to our Patreon, that's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you can get a lot of exclusive shows, including our show Only the Best, where we've been doing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. And as we've been going through in chronological order, we hit the 1940s and we started doing every film that's going to be nominated for Best International Feature. We just did the first ever winner of that, which was Shoeshine.
Yeah,
and we're about to cover in the next few weeks the French film Monsieur Vincent, which was the second film to ever win that award. And then a few years hence, they'll actually start having nominees for it, and that podcast will balloon and we'll take more time to do it. But that's over there. We also have shows about Star Trek, Batman, commentary tracks. We do trivia nights with our patrons. It's a lot of fun. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And I guess that's about it. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great few more days until we do another podcast. And bye and stuff.